Let's see. Should I wait for Dave to come back, or since he's supposed to be writing everything down? I just have to be. I'll just be careful not to erase before he comes back. Right. Okay. So last time I talked about calibrations and calibrated submanifolds. I'm hoping to learn next week what this has to do with some of the physical theories that people are interested in, and special solutions to physical theories. Today, what I want to talk about is families of calibrated submanifolds, deformations of calibrated submanifolds, and what they have to do with telling us, in some cases that we hope to understand, have to do telling us how to write down solutions to the restricted holonomy equations that we that I started out with. And I understand, for the physicists in the audience who may be getting impatient, I understand that the restricted holonomy problem is really, in some sense, a toy problem for what you're really interested in, which is that you want not just a parallel spinner, but a spinner that satisfies certain equations where the the covariant derivative is not equal to zero, but it's equal to something expressed in terms of the spin operations and some vector fields or forms and so forth, and that's the perturbed system we want to understand. And let me say at the outset that I believe that most of the things that have been done for the parallel holonomy case, the spin, the case of parallel spinners, can be generalized without much difficulty to this more general situation. But the answers are probably going to be somewhat more complicated, as you expect. So today I want to start out with deformations of calibrated submanifolds. And I'm going to give myself, all the cases that we looked at yesterday fit into the following background. I mean, satisfy the following assumptions. We started out with the data of a manifold and a metric, some Riemannian capital N manifold, a metric, the holonomy of G. It sits inside some subgroup H, sitting inside ON, in fact, SON. These are all big N. These were all oriented manifolds. And a calibration, an N form on M, that was G parallel. In fact, not only G parallel, invariant under H. G parallel is good enough at the moment. G parallel calibration. And it had the property that, in fact, the at each fiber, the set of calibrated planes was actually a homogeneous space of H. That is, G, Bx, the calibrated planes, is H homogeneous for all X and M. All these cases had that property. And we looked at the little n-dimensional submanifolds of M, on which phi restricted to be the volume form. Those were our special cycles. What I want to do now is look at what happens when you try to deform such a special cycle. And the thing to keep in mind is, in this case, of course, that what we're doing, if you have some calibrated cycle sitting inside M, a phi manifold, then what that says, of course, is that its tangent plane, in the oriented sense, the tangent plane belongs to G phi. Now, an element of the Grassmannian, G phi x, sits inside, the Grassmannian of n planes in the tangent space of x to m. And if you take an element in here, element in the tangent space, we know what the tangent space of G is. It's just E per tensor E star. It's Hom E to E per. And of course, geometrically, this is exactly what you expect. Here's E perp. Any nearby tangent plane to E, you expect to be essentially the graph of a linear map from E to E perp. And so it's not surprising that tangent space should be there. And so what that means is that this tangent space at the calibrated plane, this is some subspace of this tensor product. And I'll call that A sub E. The notation is from sometimes called the tableau of E. Right. And this naturally means that whenever we have a phi manifold, not only do we have the tangent and the normal bundles, but we also have this bundle, this A sub E, this subspace of the tensor product of those bundles sitting there in a natural way. And it's not hard to see that because, if you had a deformation of calibrated submanifolds, so here's N, and you wanted to look at a deformation of N as a and ask whether that deformation is calibrated or not, the first order condition, of course, is going to be that the tangent plane stay in G phi. And infinitesimally, that's going to be the differential equation that says that when you look at the differential of the normal map that and throw away the A of E part, then you should get zero. Right. So we have a natural projection, I'll call it pi of E, that maps E perp tensor E star to the perpendicular A E perp. and it's easy to see that the linearized deformation problem is just solving the linear equation, the linear PDE, that you get by, you want a section of the normal bundle. Oh, I told myself I was not going to call it N, but I did. The normal bundle of N. You take a section of the normal bundle. First, you take its covariant derivative. So that gives you a section of the normal bundle tensor, the cotangent bundle, one form in there. So that's morally speaking what this is at each point. And now we project it, and I'll just use pi sub n here, since it depends on the, into this bundle here, which I'll call a n. Right. And this composition, which is a linear differential operator, is the first order condition that you would have to take on a normal section, a section of the normal bundle, to know that the deformation is also calibrated. So let's get a little familiarity with this by looking at some examples. And I'll just go through the examples I did yesterday. Sorry. Nu is the normal bundle. If you look at the tangent bundle of M restricted to N, then that's the tangent bundle of N direct sum the normal bundle to N. Right? Sorry, I should have said that. And that's, of course, the tangent bundle to N there, the submanifold. And this is that vector bundle that you get by just taking those as your typical spaces, typical fibers. Right? And these things have, well, there's only one place that you have to use a connection, which is right here. These hypotheses about things being G-parallel and G-homogeneous and so forth, they make this statement essentially obvious because all these what these hypotheses say is that the geometry has no first-order invariance. That is, to first order, it's just like you're in flat Euclidean space. Nothing comes in until curvature, and since this is a first-order construction, there's nothing natural that you could have added to this that would have made any sense, and therefore you can't add anything. It's got to be this single operator here. Now, if you just look at examples. Oh, the kernel of this operator is the infinitesimal tangent space. It's the first order tangent space to the space of solutions, of the space of calibrated, the moduli space of calibrated submanifolds near there. That's what it is. Right. Near in. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that it's unobstructed. In fact, if you look at the first example that I was going to mention, if you look at complex submanifolds, the very first case, the one most people are familiar with, where you have a Kähler structure, and you take phi to be 1 over k factorial omega to the k, and of course that calibrates the k-dimensional complex submanifolds, then D, in this case, Dn, is nothing in the world but D bar, the normal bundle. D bar for the normal bundle. As you can easily check, it has to have that symbol at the top level, and there's, like I said, it's flat in first order, so there's nothing else it could be. So what that means is that the infinitesimal tangent space to moduli, the tangent space to the moduli of near n of nearby complex k-dimensional submanifolds is simply the holomorphic sections of the normal bundle. That should be new there. The holomorphic sections of the normal bundle, because it's the kernel of D bar. Now we know that unfortunately, not every complex submanifold. You can't always, and by the way, the holomorphic structure that you put here is sort of the only possible holomorphic structure you can imagine, which is, if you want to avoid the metric structure and just think in terms of complex geometry, because after all, we are talking, the deformation problem can be stated purely in the complex category. The normal bundle has to be thought of as the ambient tangent bundle modulo the submanifold's tangent bundle. But in the metric case, of course, we have a canonical splitting. Anyway, it's the holomorphic sections of the normal bundle, and unfortunately, it's well known. It's fortunate that it's well known, but it's unfortunate in some sense that it's true, that you cannot, quote-unquote, exponentiate all the holomorphic vector fields in general, if the moduli space is sufficiently unobstructed. There are tests for whether or not the moduli space is unobstructed, and in which case this actually becomes the real tangent space to moduli. But I'll let the algebraic geometers tell you about those things. What is true, even if the tangent space is obstructed, is that in a certain natural sense, you can at least near zero, you can embed the true moduli space as a subset, as an analytic subset of this finite dimensional space, the space of holomorphic sections. You get the Kuranishi moduli space. So even when the thing is singular, the tangent space is some nice guy, but then it's obstructed, and you might be at some situation like this where you can really only move in two directions, say, even though in two one-dimensional directions, even though the whole thing might be two-dimensional. That's the obstruction problem in the complex manifold case. The hypercalor case is very similar to this. And in the interest of time, let me not spend a whole lot of time on that. Let me skip over it and go straight for the thing that you're more likely to be interested in, which is, I believe, the special Lagrangian case. So, which I've forgotten what number I called it, but today I'll call it 2. If you look at the special Lagrangian case, remember we have M, big N, G, omega, holomorphic volume form, and we take our form here to be the real part of omega. And that's supposed to calibrate the Lagrangian submanifolds. It calibrates a certain set of Lagrangian submanifolds, the ones on which the imaginary part of omega is zero, so-called special Lagrangian ones. And here, it's easy to see what the tangent space, what A of E is. See, the nice thing in this case is that whenever you have a Lagrangian subspace, if E is Lagrangian, what that means in particular is that JE is E perp. That is, if you use the complex structure that omega defines, then multiplication by J, complex structure, sends every tangent vector to its perp. So E perp and E are canonically isomorphic. So you actually have, under this isomorphism, AE sitting inside E perp tensor E star. E perp is canonically isomorphic to E star. This becomes actually sim 2 0, the traceless quadratic forms sitting inside E star tensor E star. The symmetric comes from the fact that the tableau consists of symmetric things comes from the fact that intuitively you can think of it as you're setting a 2 form equal to 0, so you're getting rid of a skew symmetric part, and then the phase setting the imaginary part of omega equal to 0 gets rid of the trace. Oh, that's an inclusion there. That should include into there, and those are equal. Symmetric quadratic forms of trace 0. Sorry, maybe I should write this larger. Trace 0 quadratic forms. I see what you mean. This should be isomorphic to, right, not containing, right. I mean, under this isomorphism, this becomes this, right? That's what I mean. So what that means, of course, is that the perp, AE perp, is isomorphic to lambda 2 E star direct sum, well, a one-dimensional vector space, which I'll take to be lambda n E star. I mean, it's a trivial vector space, but there's a good reason for thinking of it as lambda n instead of lambda 0, which is, so this is, so you get this. And in particular, that allows us then to identify, make sure I say this right. Yeah, that allows us to identify sections of the normal bundle. That's identified with 1 forms on n, simply because, everything's metric. We can dualize when we want to. And the normal bundle is isomorphic to the tangent bundle. And the operator D, which is now going to sections of section, which is going to A perp n, this is isomorphic to 2 forms plus n forms, right? And under this isomorphism, this map is simply exterior derivative plus d star. Is all it is. Right. You can easily check this. Again, it's almost it's almost obvious that it has to be this because since everything's flat in first order, and it's got to be equivariant under SON, this is essentially up to scale multiples here. That's the only equivariant map there is. So it's not, there's nothing subtle about this. Now, the nice thing about this operator is that it's obvious that the kernel is topological. It has nothing to do with exactly how n is sitting inside the manifold. The kernel here, the kernel is simply the harmonic one-forms on n. So it equals Kerr. So Kerr d. So that would say that the tangent space, the first order approximation to moduli, is in fact simply the first is the one forms on n. It's and right away this fact that the dimension is independent of anything except the topology is an indication that things aren't going to be like this, where you can have the same symbol and all you get is you get an index that's constant, but the kernels and ranges can jump. Here, this cannot happen. And in fact, McLean proved that the moduli space is always unobstructed. That M is smooth near N. And the proof is actually pretty simple once you realize what you have to do. The point that you want to make is if you now look at the fully nonlinear condition. So here's N normal bundle. If you have a section, I mean, let's consider the map that just exponentiates the section. So for S in for S a section of the normal bundle, we can just look at the map which is basically, let's call it F sub S, which is F sub S at X is simply X at X of this normal vector. Right. Just do that exponentiation, and then it's not hard to see. Well, it's clear that F S mapping N into M is special Lagrangian. If and only if, well, it has to pull back omega to be zero, and it has to pull back the imaginary part of a big omega to be zero, if and only if fs star of little omega equals fs star of imaginary part of omega is zero. And lo and behold, this is exactly a two-form vanishing and an n-form vanishing. Right? So it's not surprising that you get that, you know, in the thing that makes it nonlinear, of course, is the exponentiation is nonlinear. But this map that sends S to FS star omega and FS star imaginary omega, we just need to look at the kernel of this map. We know its linearization at the identity is going to be this. The linearization at S equals 0 is going to be this. Once we interpret S as a one form by this J operation in duality. And so we can see what the critical thing to realize that proves the non-obstruction is the following fact that although this is a two form, it's always obviously closed, because it's the pullback of a closed form. But more than that, it's also obviously exact because it's a, let me call this curly ds equals this. It's also obviously exact because you just homotope s back to, omega's closed. So if you just put a little t here in front of s, you homotope back to zero, you're going to get zero. So and it changes by an exact form to zero, so it's exact. And similarly here, this is, well, the closure is not an issue here because it's top dimensional, but it's also homologous to zero, cohomologous to zero, because as you let, what in the world? Because, again, as you put a parameter t in front of here, this closed form homotops back to the zero form, and therefore you're not going to get any homology. So D actually maps not into just closed two forms and closed n forms. It maps into exact two forms and exact n forms. In other words, it completely misses the co-kernel of this operator, which is what you need to do in order to ensure that you're not going to have any obstructions. So, so the point is that D maps the sections of nu into the boundaries. Direct sum of the boundaries. And now an implicit function theorem, an easy implicit function theorem, shows you that the kernel of D has to actually be, the zero set of D actually has to be modeled on that, has to be smooth and has to be modeled on that tangent space. So obstructions vanish. Instructions vanish, and M is smooth near D, near N. Of course, that was true for any special Lagrangian submanifold. So the moduli space of compact special Lagrangian manifolds consists of a bunch of smooth components, and the dimensions of those components are completely determined by the topology of any representative submanifold, calibrated submanifold. In particular, this says things like, if it's a rational homology three-sphere, then it's rigid. You can't deform it. If it's, at the sort of, not the other extreme, but at, but to consider a more, perhaps more interesting case that I'll come back to, if the harmonic one-forms are linearly independent everywhere, form a basis for the tangent space everywhere, then this will, in fact, just by looking at what this operator says, it'll say that the torus that this thing will necessarily be must therefore, the nearby special Lagrangian submanifolds actually foliate in a neighborhood. And you get some nice foliation. And I'll come back to that when I get to the second part of the talk, which is how you might be able to use these things to get some information about the underlying metric that we started out with.
Now maybe this is a digression, but these spaces are certainly not compact.
No, there's no reason to believe they're compact. In fact, we know examples where they're not compact. But now that's the $64 question, right? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now we do know something. I mean, we have, because just like in Gromov's pseudohomomorphic curves case, we have a volume constraint. I mean, so we have a zeroth order estimate, if you want, and the geometric measure theory will tell us that we can't just converge off the wild things as we sort of pass the limits. But exactly what we can converge to is a bit of a mystery, and I'll come to that sort of in the, you know, before I get to the last part of the talk. We do know something, thank goodness. But we don't know everything we want to know. Let me now go to the G2 case, which is G2, the associative and co-associative cases. Here we have a seven-manifold, a metric, a three-form, and it's dual. A three-form and it's dual, and the holonomy sits in G2, sitting in SO7. Those of you who don't know what G2 is, it's a 14-dimensional simple group. It's the only 14-dimensional simple group. But probably the best way to describe it is to say that G2 is, in fact, the set of A in GL7R, so that A preserves this form I'll call phi naught, where phi naught is, I'll simply write it this way, dx 1, 2, 3 plus dx 1, 4, 5 plus dx 1, 6, 7 plus dx 2, 4, 6 minus dx 2, 5, 7 minus dx 3, 4, 7 minus dx 3, 5, 6, where by dx ijk means dxi wedge dxj wedge dxk. In other words, if you look at the linear transformations in seven variables that preserves that three form, that is in fact a simple group of dimension 14, and is G2. What picture? No, I don't want to draw that picture. You want me to draw the projective plane over two, field two. Well, I will make it obvious. I'll make it obvious by doing the following thing. Notice that you can group these terms, and here's why I wrote it down. You can group these terms in the following way: dx 1, 2, 3 plus dx 1 wedge dx 4, 5 plus dx 6, 7 plus dx 2 wedge dx 4, 6 minus dx 5, 7 plus dx 3 wedge dx 4, 7 minus dx 5, 6. And you'll notice that in the splitting of 1, 2, 3 against 4, 5, 6, 7, this is just the volume form on 1, 2, 3 plus basically the self-dual forms on the orthogonal 4 plane dotted with dx 1, 2, 3. It doesn't explain the last two minus signs, but then that other thing doesn't explain it either. Right. Sorry. But this is the way you want to see it, because of course the plane spanned by dx 1, dx 2, dx 3 is calibrated. It's an associative plane for this guy. And you can see what that means about what the so if you think of the splitting into R3 and R4, you can see what the stabilizer of this form is that stabilizes also that splitting. It's got to be basically any rotation in the 4 plane, and then you look at the rotation that induces on the self-dual 2 forms and do that rotation in the 3 plane. So you can see that the stabilizer, in fact, the G of phi naught is G2 mod SO4, where SO4 is sitting there, where SO4 should be thought of, if you want, using quaternion notation, thinking of this as imaginary H, and this is H. In quaternion notation, you can write this as conjugation by P, 0, 0, right multiplication by P, left multiplication by Q bar, P and Q in unit quaternions, SP1. Conjugation by P is just the conjugation by P in the imaginary part of H. This is imaginary in H. That's probably the best way to remember it. There's another grouping that also makes it easy to remember that I'll remark on in a few minutes. But it's basically impossible to forget this form. So. And besides that, if you ever do forget it, write down the generic form in seven variables, and you've got a 50-50 chance that that it'll be this one up to a change of variable. The reason it's 50-50 is because half of the forms are stabilized by the non-compact G2, and the other half are stabilized by the compact G2. And then there's some fuzz in between, not fuzz, there's a hypersurface separating the two. And but the chance that you'll hit that is nil. So. Anyway, what this shows you is that this tells us what the tangent space and the how to think of the tangent space and the normal space to an associative three-dimensional submanifold. For an associative three-dimensional submanifold, you should think of the normal space as basically the spin bundle twisted by some quaternion line bundle. That's what it is. So, thus, for associative N3 sitting in M7, the normal bundle of N is essentially the spin bundle tensor sum quaternion line bundle, where tensor over H, where L is a quaternion line bundle. And when you sit down now and work out what the AE perp, remember G has dimension 14, so, and this is a six-dimensional stabilizer, that means the space of such planes is eight-dimensional, which is codimension 4 in all planes, so it's going to be an operator from a rank 4 bundle to a rank 4 bundle, and in fact, it's basically twisted Dirac. So, and D, in this case, mapping sections of the normal bundle to sections of A perp is Dirac twisted by L. So unfortunately, well, we knew we weren't going to get any information out of it by the index theorem, because it's an odd dimensional manifold. The index is obviously going to be zero. Whatever kernel there is, there's obstructions on the other side, and there's not much you can. Both of those are rank 4 bundles. There are obstructions on the other side, and as far as we know, small perturbations. We don't have an example. I admit we do not have an example of an actual obstructed deformation, but. There's no reason to believe that it's going to be any better than this case. Sorry?
How do you know N is spin?
Well, N is orientable.
Okay.
And therefore, well, it's an orientable three manifold. It's an orientable three manifold, and therefore it is spin. Right. So, So we don't have that to worry about, thank goodness. So that's the associative case, and unfortunately I can't tell you that we know a lot about the moduli, because we don't. But for the co-associative case, N4 sitting in M7, things are nicer. Now you just reverse this picture, and you can see exactly what this thing is. It's the bundle of self-dual two forms on the four manifold. The normal bundle is isomorphic to lambda 2 plus of the tangent bundle. Yeah. And again, by the first order flatness principle, there's and I should say what A perp is isomorphic to. Well, it's a rank 4 bundle. It's not too hard to imagine what that rank 4 bundle might be. It is, in fact, the cotangent bundle. Actually, in this case, it's better to think of it as lambda 3 of the cotangent bundle. those are straightforward calculations. It's not much surprising about it. And again, now by the flatness principle, there's basically only one operator here that you can imagine putting here that would go from two forms to three forms, and it's just exterior D. Derivative. D. And here again we get lucky. 2 plus N 2 omega 3 N. And here again we get lucky. The kernel of this operator is topological. It's not, even though, you know, there wasn't going to be any index that we could associate to it. I mean, we'd have had to put it into a, fill it out into an elliptic complex, but it turns out we don't even need to do that in this case. The kernel is always the dimension first Betti number. It's in fact the self-dual two forms. And that's the, that's sort of what you, so that again is a strong hint that the moduli space of the co-associative guys might be unobstructed, since you can't have any jumping. The kernel is always a constant dimension. And although you can't, you don't have anything quite so clever as this to, and just observing that the things happen to be exact, you don't have anything quite that good for, in the co-associative case, McLean was, nevertheless, was able to show that, that the moduli space is unobstructed in this case. That the moduli space of the co-associative is smooth and of the expected dimension. I mean, basically this was a crutch. We didn't actually, I mean, this just made it obvious, but whenever you have this family of operators where there's a the kernel is clearly, you know, fixed in size, you can figure out what to project against so that you can throw that away and get a smooth manifold. It's a little bit harder, but it's not significantly harder. So we know about I don't know. Yeah, that Dirac operator is skew, and so I don't know. Maybe I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. I mean, the few explicit examples we know of associative things like this are. I mean, we can write down examples where it's certainly unobstructed. We can write down rigid examples. Things like that, but we always compute the kernel by some other method and the topology of the underlying manifold is pretty straightforward. So, yeah, I don't know. It's certainly worth thinking about. I'll think about that. I haven't. Okay. All right. And oh yeah, I don't have that much time. I only have 30 minutes left, and I need to say a few things. So I'm going to say, let me just point out that for the Cayley case, that is, you know, you have M8, G, and phi, and the holonomy is in spin 7, sitting in SO8. This case is more like the associative case, unfortunately. Is like the associative case. Like the associative case. It's like the associative case in that D is a twisted Dirac operator. Dirac operator. And again, you know, there's a loose quaternion line bundle in the normal bundle, so that it can't come down to just topological things down on the submanifold. You have to do something about fixing that line bundle before you can hope to get any information about the index. So the upshot of all this is that we know basically two very good cases. One is the special Lagrangian case, and one is the co-associative case, where we have good control over the moduli space, at least locally. But now we come to Michael's question, which is, what about the global structure of the moduli space, and what will you have to do if you're going to try and compactify it? What about compactifying? If we're going to carry out Gromov's program, we're going to have to do this at some point. One of the first things that you have to deal with is what kinds of singularities can develop. Now, in the complex case, we know a lot about what the singularities can be. Singularities are relatively well understood. And relative there refers to the understander, and it depends on what you mean by understanding, of course. It's a lot of algebraic geometers make their living still understanding those things. In the special Lagrangian case, things are not so clear, except for the n equals 2 case. In the n equals 2 case of special Lagrangian, we're okay because we happen to know because in that particular case, it's this case in disguise, since we can reduce to case 1. And what do I mean by that? This isn't just a digression here. M4 G omega, which I'll take to be the omega associated to the complex structure, and big omega, which I'll take to be omega J plus I omega K. You know, in the SU2 case, SU2 is the same as SP1, which means that this is really sort of the lowest case of a hyper-Taylor manifold. The condition, remember, the N2s in here, M4, is special Lagrangian. If and only if omega I on N is omega K on N is 0. But it's easy to see that in that case, well, since it's special Lagrangian, omega J will be the volume form on it. And omega J is a complex structure all its own. If we just consider the rotated picture here, M4, the same metric, and now omega star is omega J, and big omega star is omega K plus I omega I, then, but N here, in M4, N2 is a complex manifold, complex curve. And we feel like we understand the deformations of complex curves on complex surfaces. So we know quite a lot about what can happen. Oh, you're not coughing to call attention to it. That's really well understood. In fact, you can see it's so well understood that we can look at very well understood examples and see that you have to do some compactification. For example, even when M is compact here, if M4 is K3, I mean, in the compact case, that can be elliptically fibered. So in the picture here, fiber over some P1 here, let's say, and the fibers are tori, elliptic curves. Reach Z, and here we have an elliptic curve, EZ. And we know that in the compact case, you have to have these singular fibers. And Kadaira has a very beautiful classification of what the possibilities are. But so if you start with an elliptic curve on a K3 surface, we know that it fills out to be basically a foliation of the K3 surface minus some singular curves, some finite number of singular curves. And and we know exactly locally what the model of all this behavior is. Right. Kadaira went through a wonderful classification of what the singularities here can look like. Now, what's interesting about this case, already before I pass on to the three-dimensional case, which is, of course, the big the thing of greatest interest probably, is that although we don't know the Calabi-Yau metric explicitly, which has to be put in here to get all this story out, if we start with just the complex story of a K3 elliptically fibered in this way, we can actually recover a lot about this metric on M4. In particular, for example, if you define a volume form on the base of the elliptic fibration by simply doing this, define the volume by simply you want to know the volume of an open set down here in P1, you just pull it back to K3 to M and compute the volume of the inverse image. That gives you a volume form which, since this is a one-dimensional thing, there's a unique there's a unique conformal metric that has that volume form. So we can, if we start with the Calabi-Yau metric here, we can sort of push down and get a metric here. And the beautiful thing is that you can recover this metric ds squared completely from the knowledge of the Kadaira data that you have to specify to recover the curve here. You can write it down explicitly. So ds squared can be computed explicitly. From Kadaira data on the base. Those of you who aren't familiar with what this kind of stuff is, basically you have to specify things like the monodromy of the fiber around the singular points, and you have to specify the J invariant of the as a multivalued holomorphic function on the base. But from that data, you can cook up ds squared without much trouble, and from that you can start writing down a very beautiful Fourier series for the actual metric G, where the G naught term, you can write G as G naught plus I'll call it some Fourier. See, the fibers here are tori. In fact, you can take a reference torus T2. Away from the reference torus, T2 is R2 mod Z2. And you can mod a fixed lattice and C in Z2 like that. You can write down a Fourier series decomposition of this guy in a natural way, in a completely natural way that can be computed to higher and higher orders in terms of the size of C, by just asymptotic expansion. This guy you get immediately just from the data, just from the Kadaira data. The rest of it you have to do a little Fourier series analysis. And so, in a certain sense, you can write down the Calabi-Yau metric on the K3 from the Kadara data. You know, it's kind of amazing fact. Whether you can actually carry this out explicitly in practice, I mean, the equations, the algebraic equations you have to solve here are messy, and I doubt you could go very far unless you can think of some clever way to solve the algebra, which maybe there is some integrable systems theory. Somebody will be able to say, oh yeah, we can write that down in terms of some beta series or something like that. I don't know, but G naught, by the way, unfortunately cannot be. I mean, these terms all have to be here because G naught actually becomes singular as you go to the fibers. Although this metric G naught has the right volume upstairs, so these corrections are kind of they're more to sort of line the metric up as you come into the singular fibers. Anyway. So you get a kind of you can see how you can use these moduli spaces to start trying to actually recover the interesting metric. What about the n equals 3 case? Special Lagrangian. N equals 3. Well, if you have some L3 sitting in your M6, if L3 is a torus, and say alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 in the harmonic forms on L1 satisfy alpha 1 wedge, alpha 2 wedge, alpha 3 is not zero, then we know that we'll have a foliation, you know, given this one L, we'll have a foliation by a nearby tori. Fibered over a base, at least nearby. And what we'd like to understand is, you know, what can happen? What can go wrong? Because very likely something has to go wrong. By the way, I didn't. I should have said in the thing that saves us whenever you have an elliptic curve here is that this condition is automatic in two dimensions because alpha 1 and alpha 2 being harmonic means that they're the real and imaginary parts of the holomorphic one form, and of course they're linearly independent. So you don't have any problem with that. But the sort of the first problem you face is what are the possible singularities? Sorry? H1 is the harmonic one forms on L, and I want them to be linearly independent everywhere. I should say, by the way, that point-wise linearly independent. There, right, yeah. I should say, by the way, that we do not know, except in the case of products, we don't know a single case where the holonomy is actually all of SU3, and we have an explicit torus with satisfying this condition. We do have examples of three folds where this is a torus. I mean, three folds with a special Lagrangian submanifold where this is a torus. That's not too hard to construct. And if you believe that the Calabi-Yau metric on three folds varies in any ways reasonably continuously as you pass to the boundary and pass to certain singular limits of Calabi-Yau threefolds, that is, for example, the metric would acquire the singularities of the limiting algebraic submanifold, for example. If you believe that, then you can prove that some of those things that we know exist will actually satisfy that condition. However, people don't know enough about the Calabi-Yau metric to actually make that claim, as far as I can tell. It would be really nice if we knew that that kind of continuity existed. Anyway, so the first question is, what kind of singularities can happen? Can come up. Not in the complex category anymore. Well, one thing, because these things are known to be absolutely minimizing, and the background metric is real analytic, we know that the singularities that develop will develop in codimension 2 at worst. So singularities are codimension 2. Which is good because I mean singularities in the submanifold, not in the family. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Dominic Joyce has a recent preprint in which on the Los Alamos server in which he argues that the singularities in the moduli space will occur in codimension 1, which is disastrous, I think, for many people. Oh, right, yeah. I may have read that, sorry. What are you advocating we call it?
I don't have a name for it.
Okay. The server the server who dare not speak its name or something. That dare not speak its name, sorry. It's not a person. So singularities are codimension 2 at worst. That's good. I mean, you know, for various Stokes theorem kind of arguments, it's nice, you know, codimension 2, you can generally ignore those kinds of singularities. That's good, but just what can the singularities be? For example, what can the point singularities be like? Now, you know, in complex geometry, one of the essential things that you look at is the length of a point singularity. That is, you have here's L3. We intersect with some small sphere, and we get a link, which I can't call L because I call that L. So let me call it. It's a surface sigma. you know, what kinds of singularities can you expect to find in such a thing? One thing you can do, fortunately, is you can rule out sigma 2 cannot be a two-sphere. So, is not a two-sphere. And by that I mean that if you take a small piece of, special Lagrangian submanifold with any reasonable bound on the area inside the ball, if the link is a two-sphere, then in fact it has to be smooth. That's a removable singularities theorem that you get more or less for free from. Well, I shouldn't say for free. There's a subtle point, and that subtle point is that see, this link, if you just dilate away, if you just look at what the tangent cone can look like, just dilate away until you're basically looking at something in flat space, a cone on a surface in flat space, then that cone, that link sitting in the 5 sphere would have to be a minimal Lagrangian 2 sphere sitting in the 5 sphere. And one can prove, just like you can prove that any minimal 2 sphere in the 3 sphere is equatorial, there's a similar argument, a Hopf differential argument, that proves that any minimal Lagrangian 2 sphere in the 5 sphere is necessarily an equatorial 2 sphere. And that shows that gives you enough regularity to get a tangent plane there, and that removes the singularity by various removable singularities theorems. Sorry, what's equatorial? A great two sphere. I shouldn't have said equatorial. Is it the? I should say any minimal two sphere in the three sphere is a great two sphere. Of course, that's false in the 4 sphere. There's lots of things that can happen there. we don't know what the other possibilities are. However, we do know that it can be a torus. In fact, Harvey and Lawson wrote down a family of Tori, two Tori in the five sphere, that the cone on those was special Lagrangian, and so that gives you examples like this. In fact, this torus can be very, very weird. I mean, unfortunately, you cannot draw this in three dimensions. But this torus can fail to be invariant under the antipodal map. That is, it need not be balanced, which means that you can have a singularity come in, and in some sense, the singularity is not really real analytic, because when you analytically continue that thing, it will actually come out as a disjoint piece. You can just separate the two, and you can't see. I mean, you know, as far as Stokes' theorem and anything like that, as far as defining cycles or topology goes, those two things are completely separate objects. So you can have this kind of point, you know, torus kind of singularity develop. Well. And develop it can, not just sit there existing. Joyce has shown that you can actually approach these tori in the limit. I mean, these cones on tori can approach cones on tori on these tori. Through L tildes that are either smooth or have a single circle embedded in them as a singularity, or have a singular circle embedded as a singularity. Not only that, he shows that there are. He doesn't show. He conjectures that this is persistent. It's stable. That is, if you perturb away from the flat metric, these examples are all in the flat metric. that you can carry along one of these special Lagrangian guys with, say, a circle as a singularity, embedded as a singularity. You can carry that along through perturbations. It's stable that way. That's a little bit disturbing. In fact, he argues, perhaps conjecture is too strong a thing to say at this point, but he argues that these things with singularities will occur in codimension one. Things with singularities of dimension one will occur in codimension one in the moduli space. So he says that you should think of the moduli space as having a boundary. Although, as far as I can see, there's not an argument. I have not fully digested his paper, so I can't swear that I understand it perfectly well. But as far as I can understand it, it looks as though the thing actually continues on this side. It's just that you have these codimension one singularities, these sort of hypersurfaces in the moduli space that you can't do much with. Whether that will turn out to be terrible for Gromov-Witten theory, I don't know. It's hard to say at this point. This paper also contains, I'm not going to talk about this mainly because I don't understand it at all, but it also contains his first attempt at trying to define a Gromov-Witten style invariant based on counting with the right weights the rational homology three spheres that are special Lagrangian in the three manifold. I mean, in the ambient six manifold. Oh yeah, here we go. This is Joyce. July 1999. Right. That's this uncounting special Lagrangian homology three spheres. That's his paper. Let's see. Well, this is it's a little bit discouraging, but it's not. On the other hand, there's I don't think I don't think these singularities are going to be that terribly discombobulating for doing certain counts anyway. I was going to say, although you guys know this better than I do, that there's this the mirror conjecture, of course, says that when you have a special Lagrangian foliation like this, you should be able to get find the mirror somehow, also foliated over the same base, where what you have to do to get the points of this is look at these special Lagrangian tori together with a flat U1 line bundle over the torus. That's what gives the torus fibrations on this side. That's the conjecture as I understand it. And what you might think, sort of the first term, I should also write down, Hitchin has a paper about the same time. It's a set of lectures. This is, sorry, wrong, Math DG. 9907034, 6 July, in which he looks at this case of this Lagrangian vibration and gets what I would consider to be on this side gets what I would consider to be the analog of G naught on the mirror. This is, of course, it's really a sort of an attempt to pin down and make precise, and hopefully get somewhere near a proof of the SYZ correspondence that Strom and Juyao and Zaslow proposed some years ago. If he can figure out how to do this expansion, it will be very interesting, I think. So, there are similar things that you can say in the co-associative case. I'm out of time really, so, and I didn't have anything profound to say about it. So I think maybe I should stop here. One whole area that I didn't get much chance to talk about, maybe I can talk with people in private, particularly after I understand a little bit more from the lectures next week about D-brains and stuff like that, these perturbations of the holonomy condition the reason we looked at special holonomy, the reason apparently that special holonomy became important to begin with was in this context to begin with is because it represented sort of the ground zero, sort of the simplest case of this, as I said, this perturbed spinner equation problem that I'm hoping to understand somewhat better. And the special submanifolds continue to exist, but of course they get a different interpretation. I don't have a whole lot to say about it right now, so maybe I'll just stop. So.